community that the nearest thing that you would have to it now in Charlotte maybe would be deal work. Maybe would be deal work in terms of just facilities. It had two movie theaters, a library, two funeral homes, two colleges, a high school, an elementary school, probably six nightclubs, probably 20 restaurants, a Elks Club, a YMCA, a YWCA, two commercial laundries, a commercial ice house, 23 churches big enough for people to remember, and probably another 10 little storefront churches. A pharmacy, doctors, dentists, two newspapers. Now this is one neighborhood.
What made this community so special to have all this stuff?
Segregation was part of it. Segregation was a big part of it because all of these things were concentrated, and instead of being scattered like that, I know they were concentrated in one community. And the other fact, it was urban. It was the largest urban, it was right downtown. I mean, it was the largest urban black community. You had three other predominantly black neighborhoods. One been First Ward, Third Ward, and Cherry would have been communities that was close to downtown. But they were more residential. First Ward had a strip along 7th Street where the Afro-American Cultural Center had a little strip along 7th Street, and had a few cafes and a few clubs, but it was nothing like Brooklyn. So what made it was, one, it was in downtown. It also had two service stations. The fact that it was located right near downtown Charlotte, and it was sort of the city park. So that's what made it. I think that's what attracted folks. And when I say attracted folks, it was not just a center for Charlotte. I mean, people came from Gastonia and Kannapolis and Concord, upper part of South Carolina. I mean, it was a place where on Friday and Sunday night, that's where black folks from all over this area came to Brooklyn.
So it was really the happening spot.
It was the happening spot. Stephen, there were some Friday nights and Saturday nights where 2nd Street between Boyd and Caldwell, you literally couldn't, if you were coming down the street, you had to walk in the street. There were so many people on the sidewalks until you had to literally walk. It would be like Mardi Gras in New Orleans on the weekends, especially after during the Second World War and right after the war, in the late 40s and early 50s. On the weekends, it was like a Mardi Gras every weekend. I mean, it was just wall-to-wall people. Yeah. Very exciting place, very stimulating place to be. Now, I'm not painting any kind of rosy picture, if I'm supposed to be a historian, I have to tell the truth. It was also one of the worst slums that has ever been in this town. I mean, you had people who lived in houses that were on stilts, literally built over creeks. Creeks ran under the houses. There was no driveway to the houses, outdoor plumbing, and the commercial laundry they did a lot of dyeing, and in the afternoons they would flush out their washing machines, and the creeks on these houses would turn purple or green, whatever dye they were flushing, and the stench was terrible. So it was some of the worst slums, and it also some of the nicest homes where a lot of upper income, middle class blacks who lived, and teachers and other professionals who lived in the area. So at one time it was this wonderful place, at the other time it was this horrible slum.
Was there any tension between the slummer parts of the area and the upper end houses?
Oh yeah, that was social segregation within the community, yeah. And some physical separation, yeah. In fact, one of the ways the house prayer, where we're sitting here talking, one of the ways the house prayer got started was because Bishop Graves, who was the founder, was one of the first folks who would even deal with the slum folk in Brooklyn. I mean, he put up a tent down off Long Street and specifically pointed his ministry toward those, the least of thine brethren. Yeah, and that's, he started with folk in those low-income areas in Brooklyn, yeah.
Was the, Blue Haven,
Blue Heaven.
Yeah, Blue Heaven, excuse me. Was that the only slum, the more slum part of that Brooklyn, or was there other portions of it? Or was Blue Heaven a slum at all?
Blue Heaven was a mixture. Blue Heaven was probably not the worst slum in Brooklyn. Blue Heaven had, there were a lot of rental houses and some homeowners in Blue Heaven. But Blue Heaven was across what is now Independence Boulevard, or Stonewall at that time, and it butted up to the back of Moorhead Street, the houses at the front on Moorhead Street, the back of the house. Blue Heaven sort of butted up to what is now still the little park on there, Pearl Street Park.
Okay.
Well, Blue Heaven was in that section between McDowell, Stonewall, and then the back of the house on Moorhead Street. So Blue Heaven was not that. The worst slums was on Long Street and coming down Second Street. Second Street did not cross McDowell. It stopped in McDowell and then sort of picked up on the other side of McDowell. But that was those houses over those creeks, that was probably the worst one. Yeah, down in the section where the house press started, that was probably the worst one. Then you had some alleys, like Wade's Alley, and I don't remember the name of those alleys, but all those alleys tend to be pretty rough too, because a lot of them didn't even have streets. I mean, they were just
the dirt streets.
Dirt streets, yeah. And, well, they weren't even streets. They were just dirt places where you could walk. You literally couldn't drive a car to most of these houses. Yeah.
What? In your opinion, why did the urban renewal program start?
It depends on whether I want to be kind or cynical.
Either way.
Let me be both. Let me be kind first. That was Lyndon Johnson and some folks in federal government had the mistaken impression that under something called the Great Society, that if you tore down these slums, then they could be replaced by businesses, and that the residents who were in those slums were being relocated to other housing kind of thing. Now, that was the theory. What most folk in the black community called urban renewal was Negro removal, or black removal, and it had to do with the fact that it was an attempt to break up black businesses and destroy the black community. In other words, if we can disrupt every major city you went in this country, you had the largest black churches, the majority of black businesses would be located, whether you're talking about Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Oklahoma City, or Dallas, Texas, or Charlotte, or Wilmington. You had the same pattern. Segregation had forced black businesses into one location. And that location tended to have a certain strength. I mean, you know, folks own their own businesses, they own their own home, they have professionals there. And in most cases, there were slums that grew up around them. In most cases, the slums were owned by absentee landlords who were not black folk.
Yeah.
And so they had just simply taken advantage of a situation. So the theory was, if we get rid of these slums, everybody will live happily ever after. But the problem was, it was a Pyrrhic victory in the sense that you got rid of the slum, but you also got rid of churches, you scattered businesses who were never able to recover, and you scattered people. So it was probably the most devastating blow to the African American community in this country, other than, I would put slavery first, Jim Crow laws second, and urban renewal third in terms of destruction of the black community.
Do you think there's any way that the black community can regain what was lost during urban renewal?
No way. Now, does that mean that we won't live happily ever afterwards? I don't believe that. But what was lost in urban renewal was a sense of community. In that you couldn't go back right now if the federal government said, okay, we made a mistake. We're going to allocate $100 billion, and you can go back and build these communities just like they no way you could reconstruct these communities, even if you could raise all the folk from the dead and give them no way you could do, because that was a special kind of, these communities grew over a particular time and grew in a particular way, and there would be no way you could replicate that. And so it's like a we had a we being the Mecklenburg County Black Heritage Committee had what we call a healing ceremony in October of last year at Marshall Park, which was part of Brooklyn. We invited House of Prayer and all the churches, and the whole idea, and the mayor was there, and the mayor apologized for urban renewal and that kind of thing. The whole idea was to try to bring about some healing. I was a college student at the time of urban renewal, and one of the jobs I got as a part-time jobs I got as a college student was to go through Brooklyn and interview people ostensibly to find out what they needed in these houses that they were going to be moved into, and you know, how many bedrooms do you need, how many kids do you have, and all of that stuff. Well, no houses were built as a result of Brooklyn being torn down. Not only was no houses built, other stable communities were then inundated with people who were forced out of Brooklyn. Places like Cherry, Greertown, Biddleville, First Ward, they were inundated with strangers, folks who didn't want to move, and then other communities didn't want these new people in. And so not only did it destroy Brooklyn, it almost destroyed, some of these communities are just now recuperating from what happened back in the 60s. Just now, for instance, Greertown is just now recuperating. Cherry is just now recuperating. First Ward never recuperated. I mean, Earl Village come and gone, and the whole character of First Ward has changed. So the only two communities that are still somewhat similar to their original status would be Cherry and Greer Heights. And they are still struggling to regain their footing. Now, these were both quiet, really nice communities until urban renewal dumped all of these folk in them. And so you had old line folks who lived in these communities, you had new people who came in, and that, like oil and water, never mixed. You had crime between these folks, I mean, tension between these folks, and it just ruined these communities. And so there's just no way that it could be replicated.
Talk a little bit about the police force in Brooklyn. Was there a white police force, or just
The police force in Brooklyn, I mean, the police department pretty much left Brooklyn to its own devices. In fact, what is now First and McDowell, where the Aquatic Center is, and Marshall Park, right? Well, the street doesn't exactly, the streets have been sort of moved around, but it was known as the murder capital of North Carolina, First and McDowell, because it was just, on the weekend, it was just, in fact, it got so bad, that's how we got the first black police officers in town.
Really?
White police officers didn't want to go to Brooklyn. And so the police department said, okay, what we'll do is we'll hire some black folks now. These guys had no car. They couldn't arrest any white people. The only folk they could arrest were black folks, and they had to arrest black folks in Brooklyn and then call the police to come and pick them up and take them to jail. They did not have a car. They walked the beat in Brooklyn. So the first couple of black police in Charlotte were restricted to Brooklyn. That was their only job, was to patrol Brooklyn. And then if something happened, they'd call the police department. They'd come and they'd have to arrest the guy, and then they'd call the police and they'd come and pick him up.
That sounds like a dangerous job for the policeman.
It was a dangerous job for
black policemen.
It was, because there was some serious resentment from a lot of black people by police officers. And so this first, one of the first police officers' name was James Ross, no relation to me, but he must have killed three or four people, and I don't know how many folks he shot. Nobody probably knows how many folks he shot, just because he was, I mean, because they didn't, first of all, they didn't respect him as police officers. They didn't believe they were police officers. And so they would, I mean, almost every time they'd go to arrest someone, it'd be a fight. And so, and Ross's theory was shoot first and call the police. Yeah, shoot first and then call the police. Yeah. So that was, and it was years later and a gradual thing that these guys really became professional police officers. I mean, that's another whole story itself, but they did gradually become full-fledged police officers, but only after some years later. Now, at the House of Prayer, had its own police force.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. And the guy wore a badge and carried a gun. They had the police, I mean, the House of Prayer had its own, I guess it would be called security force, yeah.
Was that like with all the churches, or was just
no, no, that was just House of Prayer. Again, keep in mind where the House of Prayer was located. Yeah, yeah. Now, the House of Prayer also had an interesting arrangement with the police department. The chief of police at that time was Chief Littlejohn, and he was a strange guy, old South kind of police officer. And if you remember the House of Prayer, they usually on because of the reputation of the House of Prayer, they just released the House of Prayer. If you were in the House of Prayer and you got arrested over the weekend, a lot of times you didn't even have to make bail. Chief would allow you to, you know, to be released in the name of one of the House of Prayer ministers, or just you prove your House of Prayer minister. I mean, member, you know, they'd let you go because House of Prayer people kind of took care of, you saw them as being responsible for it.
How did they get that reputation?
It was earned. It was earned that Bishop Grace was very, very conservative in his approach. And you did things right way. You know, you took care of your family and you took care of responsibilities. And so his reputation with the police department was one of maybe respect. That would be a word. They respected the bishop.
When I talked to Mrs. Elder, she would talk about the parades that the House of Prayer would.
Yeah. It was the, in fact, it was the only parade, black or white, it was the only real parade in Charlotte at that time. And it would happen during what is called convocation during the month of October. And the bishop would come into town, and so bands from Virginia and South Carolina and North Carolina, all over the Southeast would come. And so you had all of the various auxiliaries in the House of Prayer. You had the ushers and I don't know the name, but you had nurses and ushers and choirs and bands and different auxiliaries. All of them had names and they had uniforms. And so the parade would be, the parade would probably be 3 or 4 blocks long, maybe even longer than that. And then of course the bishop would be the last one in the parade, and he would, you know, everything was decorated, and people would, the parade would come along McDowell Street. And the whole parade route would be just lined with folks knee-deep. Now, not only, and then, of course, the House of Prayer, that whole week was Convocation Week, and so there would be people selling stuff, food and trinkets and that thing along the street. The House of Prayer was on Long Street, so all along Long Street, people would have what they call stands. They would sell things like shaved ice, snowballs, and fish and chicken and hot dogs and sunglasses or whatever, that kind of stuff. But it was a big deal. I mean, people came from all over the Southeast United States to the House of Prayer, and both black and white would come to the
House
of Prayer.
Really, black and white.
Yeah, it was a spectacle. It was something to see.
To be honest.
Yeah.
Where did they stay when they came?
With other people. I mean, that was okay, Bob. That was literally, well, that was two black hotels in Charlotte, Hotel Alexander and another smaller hotel. And then you had some rooming houses, but folk would just, you would stay with relatives. Yeah, you would stay with relatives.
All these people in Brooklyn, it just must have been the size.
It was a and then the other thing, Brooklyn had a high school. There were 2 black high schools in town, Second Ward and West Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And Second Ward, now, you know what was interesting, Second Ward was in Second Ward, but nobody, I'm 69 years old and I never heard anybody refer to Second Ward as Second Ward. Anytime you heard the word Second Ward, people talk about the high school, Second Ward High School. Now, Second Ward High School originally was called Charlotte Colored High School. And I don't know when the change was made, but then it became known, the legal name or became Second Ward High School. So after that, when you heard the word Second Ward, you thought about a high school. You didn't think about a ward. Now, First Ward is still called First Ward, and Third Ward, and Fourth Ward. But Second Ward, as far as I'm and concern was never called Second Ward. It was always about the high school. Now the high school was located there. It was a high school during the day, and then after Second World War, it was a junior college at night. It was Carver Junior College at night. So the school was open from, say, 7 in the morning till maybe 11 at night. And it was a focal point of not just, it was a focal point of everything west of Tryon Street. When Charlotte sort of divided itself into two communities as far as black folk concerned. From Tryon Street west was West Charlotte as far as black folk concerned, and from Tryon Street east was Second Ward as far as was Brooklyn as far as, and I'm not talking about geographic, I'm just talking about psychological.
Yeah.
And we, Second Ward had the only gym in town. High schools in those days didn't have gymnasiums. I mean, the white high school did, black high schools had gymnasium. At Second Ward, when I first started there, the auditorium and the gymnasium was the same thing. You had a, it wasn't a regulation basketball court. They would take the seats out of the bottom of the auditorium and play basketball. And then after the game was over, you put the seats back. So later, maybe 49 or 50, they built a brand new auditorium at Second Ward, I mean a gymnasium, with lockers and showers and a regulation basketball floor. The problem was, didn't get West Charlotte one, or Plato Price, or J.H. Gunn. So in order for those guys to play inside, they had to play in our gym. Well, if you went to West Charlotte, I mean, if you were West Charlotte basketball team, you came to Second Ward to play basketball, you could win the game, but you're gonna lose the game and the fight. You're gonna the best you could get would be one out of two. You would either win the game and lose the fight or lose the game and the fight. Because you had to, if you were Charlotte, you had to get all the way to Tryon Street before you were in safe territory. So that was tough. I used to feel sorry for the guys from West Charlotte. That was tough.
How intense was the rivalry between?
Oh, I mean, people talk about Duke and Carolina and Clemson and this blood. I mean, between West Charlotte and Second Ward, it was blood. And that was the biggest event in the black community other than the House of Prayer convocation was Queen City Classic. It was a football game between Second Ward and West Charlotte at Memorial Stadium. And it was the biggest event in the wintertime. The biggest event in the summer was the House of Prayer Parade, but the biggest event in the wintertime was the Queen City Classic between Second Ward and West Charlotte. I mean, people still, to this day, you go down to some auto shop someplace where guys hang around, go down to the golf course, and you hear those guys lying about how many touchdowns they scored or what happened. But I mean, that was the last one was played in the 60s, the last game played, and there guys who still talk about the, you know, the Queen City Classic of 68 or 52 or whatever it was. Yeah, it was fierce. It was fierce rivalry. Yeah.
Could that explain some of the conflict when the residents of Brooklyn were forced out to these other communities? Was this a continuation of that?
Not at that level. It was you had tight-knit communities in Charlotte. I mean, when I said tight-knit, you had black neighborhoods, you had Billville, you had Greenville, you had Greertown at that time, you had Southside, and each one of these communities had its own baseball team, had its own identity. And they didn't take kindly to new people coming in. And so when you had, I mean, you know, if a family moved in, that was one thing. But when you had just a grove of people moving in, it was hard. They just didn't like the idea of all these strangers moving in. Because it changed the community. It forced the communities to change. Each of these communities had a couple of churches and a way of life, and people had been there. For instance, I grew up out in Greer Heights, and I literally knew everybody in the neighborhood. I knew if I saw a dog going down the street, I knew whose dog it was. You didn't lock your doors in the summertime, because if somebody stole something, if you came home, someone was missing, you know who we say, oh yeah, JC, go down to JC's and find out why he came by here and took that 15 cents off the dress or something. I mean, you know the kids in the neighborhood who would steal and who had more sense of going to somebody's house. So you had that kind of close-knit, it was like an extended family. All these communities were like extended families, and so that was resentment, you know, of new people coming in. Yeah, especially 15 or 20 families in a year that moved in, it just cause problems.
There's just too much.
It was too much.
Was the NAACP involved at all in Brooklyn during the urban renewal process, or is this just?
No, because there were protests of urban renewal, protests by the churches. First of all, it was said that no churches could remain. Now, there were some churches, House of Prayer, Friendship, St. Paul Baptist Church. There were probably 6 or 7 large churches that could have stayed. But the theory was, or at least a lot of it was told, was that no churches could remain. But First Baptist Church, right? First Baptist within sole property to, and they're still there. But all the black churches were forced out. So that would have, the protests, what were the protests? Businesses protesting, individual families protesting, but the feds, I mean, you had urban renewal and urban relocation. There were 2 offices that the feds set up. It was funded by the feds and at the city of Charlotte. Relocation's job was to help the folks who were forced out, business situation, everything, to find a new location. They were given money, and families were given some money, business were given some money, and the E.W. Wardell was head of relocation, and one of the saving grace of all of that stuff was he was African American. His brother was principal at Second Ward High School, and E.W. made sure that people got something out of the deal financially. I mean, he really pushed hard for people to get more. I mean, you had some little businesses that was, some guy ran some kind of little snack place. I mean, it was a business only in the broadest sense of the word. And they'd end up getting maybe $25,000 or $30,000, and the business wasn't worth that. But Wardell would push. Well, again, his argument was that the business might not be worth that, but this is the way this guy makes his living, so we ought to. So Wardell helped a lot of people by pushing to help the churches to get more than they would have gotten otherwise. So that was, but that was just not a big protest to the whole thing by the NAACP or anybody else. I mean, what do you, there was some other things we were protesting at the same time, and urban renewal was just another, now people didn't like it, people raised hell about it, but there was no organized protest against it that I know of.
What was the worst thing that happened in response to urban renewal from the community? What was the worst type of protest that would happen? Was it just a bunch of words, or was it a bit of marches? Or?
Well, people would go down to City Hall and go before City Council and that kind of thing. That would be probably the, there were no organized marches or anything like that. People just, and a lot of it was individuals, maybe either protesting they weren't getting enough money, or just protesting the whole, going to City Hall and protesting against the whole concept of urban renewal, that kind of thing. And then there were, but it was more, this whole thing is wrong, what you're doing to us, rather than there's no way you can stop it. No way you can stop it. So the protest was, okay, you can't stop it, but this isn't right what you're doing.
Like a moral victory type of
moral thing. Victories, yeah.
Oh, that's Mrs. Elder would talk about the church bells.
On Sunday mornings, see, you had 23, and the reason I'm using the word, I mean, the number 23 is because I did some research and just asked for, you know, how many churches remember in Brooklyn. We came up with 23 churches that were large enough to be remembered, and they all would say, but that was a little old church someplace, whatever. So you had the House of Prayer, St. Paul Baptist Church. Now these are the churches I'm going to name are some of the largest black churches still in existence in Charlotte. St. Paul Baptist Church, the House of Prayer, Mother House of Prayer, Brooklyn Presbyterian Church, which merged with, and became, I think, merged with 7th Street, Grace AME Zion Church, let's see, Grace AME Zion Church, and I'm sure there's some others, but on Sunday mornings, the all of these churches, most of the churches had church bells, and so Brooklyn would literally be alive at, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, it would be alive with church bells. And it was, Miss Ella may have been remembering this thing I did when we were working on inviting his church back. I asked them to close their eyes and just think of a Easter Sunday, let's say 1950, just an Easter Sunday in Brooklyn, and what the sight would have been. And the sidewalks all over Brooklyn would have been alive with people in their Easter finery. Everybody walked to church because the church was located, not everybody, but the 90% of folks walked to church. And so folks would be walking. Most folks only live eight or 10 blocks away from their church. Most of them live within 3 or 4 blocks of the church. And so it would be like a parade on every street in Brooklyn. It'd be like this parade of people walking to church in their Easter finery, little girls dressed up in the pinks and all of this kind of thing. And that would be a sight to see every Easter. Just, and then, of course, Easter Monday was like an unofficial holiday in North Carolina at that time, at least in Charlotte, Easter Monday. And again, it'd be a parade. Now, Easter Sunday, you did all of the religious kind of thing. Easter Monday, you put on those same clothes, but it was for a different purpose. Now you wanted to kind of show off, your Easter stuff. So Easter Monday, the clubs would be open, and there was all of these things that went on. So Easter was another big festive kind of holiday in Brooklyn. And so people began put on their finest clothes and come to Brooklyn to be seen. So 2nd Street on Easter, McDowell Street and 2nd Street on Easter, it was something to see. Yeah. I mean, people would come from Rock Hill and Gastonia and Fort Mill and Chester and Albemarle and Baden and places like that. They dress up and come to Charlotte to be seen. You want to be seen on 2nd Street on Easter, yeah.
Where did they shop? Is there like a strictly?
No, there were no clothing stores in Brooklyn. No, there were no clothing stores. The kind of businesses were restaurants, cafes, a couple of grocery stores. Something was interesting when I mentioned Dilworth not having some of the amenities. You had two major shoeshine parlors. It's hard to get a shoeshine in Charlotte, but at the time you had two major shoeshine parlors on McDowell Street, right about where Adams Mark Hotel is now. One was Milton Gasaway shoeshine parlor, and this other guy, I can find nobody who knows this guy's real name. His shoeshine parlor was called Custard Pies. And I've asked every old guy that I can, person I'm in this town, what was Custard Pie's real name? And nobody knows anything. But on Sunday, Milton and Custard would shine shoes. And then they would have so many shoes that they would line the shoes along McDowell Street. And so you come down McDowell Street, and then just for maybe half a block, there were all of these shine shoes. You know, people would come along and just, pick their shoes up and go pay for them and go in. So I mentioned the Ice House and all this other, but those shine parlors, yeah. Now, those were the two big ones. Now, you had a bunch of smaller shine parlors. Then, of course, you had pool halls and nightclubs. And you must have had, in Brooklyn proper, you must have had 7 nightclubs. A place called the High Ground, and then there was a gay club. Now, it wasn't called a gay club in those days. It was called the, probably it would have been called a Sissy. It was called a Promocena. I have no idea how to spell it, but it was right across from the gym, from Second Ward Gym on My Street, called Club Promocena, and that was where the where gay folks hung. I mean, straight people could go there, but that's where gay folks, they'd have what they used to call a sissy's ball every year, and guys would dress up in drag, and that was a big deal. These guys with evening gowns, and they would cross-dressing. That's not what's the word I'm looking for. I guess they were, in drag. These guys would come in drag. Yeah, that was a big deal. And so all of this stuff, Brooklyn was a very dynamic place. A place like Dilworth, Dilworth is a nice place, but in terms of a dynamic place, no place, even the nearest thing you probably have to it now would be over in Noda, over north, but nothing, the dynamics there. All of these nightclubs had bands. And so that's where musicians cut their teeth. Guys like Nappy Brown, who was still around, an international guy. Nappy Brown, there was a group called Eight Man and the Gay Poppers. That was a group, Chris Harrison and the Delicatas, Jerry Shepherd and the Swinging Shepherd. All of these guys played in these little clubs. And some of these guys are still around. All these guys played in little clubs, That's where these musicians cut their teeth in.
How come the businesses didn't survive, by and large, after they left Brooklyn?
A lot of them never even relocated.
They didn't try?
No, they didn't even try. I mean, a lot of the people were old. Now, that was some who left Queen City. The pharmacy that was in Brooklyn was Queen City Pharmacy. And it, in fact, it's right up the street, but it never lived up to, I mean, it wasn't even a pharmacy when it moved. It was just you couldn't even call it a drugstore. It was just a guy got some money and he didn't want to go out of business, but he tried to call it Queen City Pharmacy, but it was, I'm not sure what to call it. And the building is still here on Bedford Road, but it never. Now, the only business was the Amazon House. It's still in the same place. It's no corner. It's at the corner. And they had money, and it was a business, and they didn't have to stay. Grace Amazon Church also stayed. It's on Bavard Street. Whereas the business was located on Bavard, for some reason, was able to stay. But everything else had to go.
What was the community's reaction to Stan Brookshire?
To Brookshire?
Yeah.
I think respect. Now, if you ask me personally, I still hold him as the standard by which all mayors of Charlotte are measured. He was a tough old guy. I mean, I like Brookie. That's what we call him, Brookie. I like Brookie because he was tough. I mean, he was fair. He was one of the last of, he was a southern gentleman in the real sense of that word, okay? And as some of us guys who've been around for a while jokingly say, they don't make white people like Brookshire anymore. He was the last of what used to be called a southern white man. Now, I don't mean a southern redneck. I don't mean a southern reactionary. I'm talking about a guy who, if he gave you his word, that's all. If he told you he was going to do something, you could count him. I remember Jim Polk, who was my boss at the time in my first professional job. I was an angry young man. I had an afro out to here and used to raise hell every time I got a chance to. Not idle hell, but I was angry because of it was a lot of stuff to be angry about. But my anger was always directed not at individuals but at the situation. So I never got any death threats. I never got any foolishness because I wasn't about foolishness. I was about changing what we were involved in. So Brookshire called Jim Polk one day and said, you know, I keep hearing about all these angry young men. I think Charlotte is a good place to live. I'd like to meet some of these angry young men. So Jim said, well, I got two that I think you would. So he called me and Frederick Douglass Ford. who both worked for him. We were both in our 20s, I guess. And he said, Mayor Charlotte would like to meet two angry young black men, and I think you guys ought to go over and talk with him. So we went over and met with Brookshire in his office. In fact, his story I'm going to tell you is located in this book that this guy wrote about, Brookshire, Bell, and one other mayor. So the first thing he came in, we sat down, we introduced ourselves, sat down, and he said, let me give you the official policy of Charlotte, of the city of Charlotte. And the first thing he talked about was hiring people if they were qualified. And that was qualifying in those days. That was the wrong word to use because you always said, we'll hire any black who's qualified. Now, the qualification meant that you had to memorize the Declaration of Independence, know the Constitution by heart, and be able to leap over tall buildings with a single bound. I mean, that kind of bullshit. So when we heard the word, he first thing out of his mouth was, we'll hire anybody who's qualified. And 30 minutes later, he was still reeling on the attack from us. So he said, okay, all right, well, let's leave that and just tell me what it is that you are angry about. And so we went on and on. And he listened. I mean, he wasn't just, he listened. And we had a good meeting. Afterwards, he said, you know, I had never looked at Charlotte from the standpoint that you guys are talking about Charlotte. And I really appreciate, and I can see why you're mad. I mean, if I had been treated that way, I'd be mad too. We can do something about this. But I still think qualification is a good word. we can't hire unqualified, but I still think that's a good word. Okay, Mayor. But anyway, so that was, he started the Mayor's Community Relations Council, put teeth in it. I mean, this is what Charlotte never had. You know, one of the things that really ticks me off now is that there are some folk who, I've heard two attacks on Charlotte recently by folk who moved here from someplace else in the last couple of years, and they attacked Charlotte for not rioting during the riots. As if we were some kind of wimpy town that was so, black folk were so afraid and white folk were so powerful that black folks didn't riot. The reason we didn't riot in Charlotte, because there was no reason to riot, because we had dialogue and we were able to get some things done. Now, you know, no one has said to my face this crap about why did you guys riot? You must have been some kind of whip that you didn't ride. Like there was some kind of, hell, Newark is still trying to, Watson, Newark is still, that's been 40 years and they're still trying to dig out a rubble of a riot. And so for somebody to come back now with some kind of rewriting of history, and these are folks who missed out on this whole civil rights struggle in some kind of way. I ain't gonna get into all of that, but they better not approach me with that crap about Charlotte didn't riot. The reason it didn't riot was because we did some things, this community did some things to keep from rioting. I mean, it never got to the point where the thing was so desperate we had to riot. Now, does that mean we live happily ever after? No, but I would put Charlotte up in terms of people getting along against any community in this nation. Yeah, Charlotte is a good place to live. Now, we're perfect and no, not even close to it. But I don't know any place else that a person from out of town can move into a community and in 3 years move to the top, no matter what. George Sheehan did it, Bill Sims did it, Gloria King did it. Folks, you can move into this town in 3 years, you can travel in the top circle. You can't do it in Richmond, you can't do it in Atlanta, you can't do it in New York, you can't do it. I don't believe you can do it at the level you can do in Charlotte, any place in this town. Charlotte, one of Charlotte's secrets is that it has it's a pretty open society. You don't have to be from Charlotte in order to do well in Charlotte.
You're talking about the Community Relations Committee for the mayor. What was its magic trick to be able to do as much as it was?
Real commitment from the people who served on the council. The mayor appointed the council and they appointed some folks who were not afraid to get something done. Now, later on, it turned into, as far as I'm concerned, a farce. I mean, it's, you know, it once the civil rights whole thing kind of melt away. It never found an identity, and I think even today it still does not have a real identity because it didn't change with the times. It never adapted to where Charlotte is now. I don't think what it's doing and where Charlotte is now are just two different things. It's pretty much a bureaucracy. Now, these are my opinions, pretty much a bureaucracy now. But at the time, he appointed some folk who were not afraid to challenge the status quo, and then some other folks who were not afraid to change. And so that was a big reason why Charlotte didn't go up in flames, because of the Community Relations Council, some things he was able to do, and the kind of people who served on that council.
Well, what was the race relations like in Charlotte? Was there any problems? Or?
Oh, my, yeah. Everything you can name. I mean, we had a Jim Crow society. You had separate facilities. Schools, libraries, hospitals, everything was separate. What was interesting in terms of integration, in terms of housing, Charlotte was probably more integrated in 1946, let's say, than in 2004 in Greer Heights, where I grew up. You had white families there. There are no white families that I know of who live in Greer Heights. At the time I grew up, that was one whole street in Greer Town that whites lived on. Then there was another street that you had black and white families lived on. Almost every neighborhood. Now, there was not the social interaction between blacks and whites that you would find between the black neighborhood, the neighbors, and white neighbors. In the little community where I grew up, the only person in the community that had a telephone was a white family. And so if anybody had an emergency or whatever, and so that they, I mean, she was like a telephone operator, like Kinko's or something. You know, people, they had to make a telephone call, or folks would call in, they'd bring the message. So you had that kind of integration of housing. Now, beyond that, it was but all of the evils of Jim Crow and segregation, Charlotte was just no different from any other place. Now, I won't say it was no different, but it was different in that while Charlotte was segregated, you place like Gastonia, Wilmington, Greensboro, Durham, all developed their own banks or insurance companies or savings and loans and that kind of thing. Charlotte never had a black savings and loan, a black bank, black insurance company, because you could go to a bank and borrow money. You usually had to get some white person to sign for you, but you could go. In other communities, like these mechanics and farmers developed in Durham, because you could not only borrow money, you couldn't even get some white person to go sign for you to borrow money. So these places had to start their own banks. Now, I'm not saying that what was in Charlotte was good. I'm just saying it was different.
Yeah. Well, what was the main occupation of the black population during this time?
You had a lot of small businesses. For instance, my father, in those days, you didn't have bulldozers and backhoe diggers and all this stuff. And so, doing